Gear Patrol just called their ISO-certified dive watch the best sub-$500 dive watch. Full stop. And their ceramic watch material almost magical. The Wall Street Journal called them iconoclastic cool, potentially redefining the industry itself. Who are we talking about? It's Movement. And they're leveling up your gift-giving with the biggest deals of the holiday season and the sleekest watches around. Shop 30 to 60% off Movement's variety of designs, colorways, and functionalities. From the thinnest automatic dress watch under $500 to waterproof guarantee adventure-ready sport watches to rare ceramics, Movement's got options for everyone on your list. Whether you're gifting for family, friends, or yourself, be the good gifter this year with Movement's huge site-wide holiday sales and enjoy the usual fast and free shipping. Shop 30 to 60% off now at movement.com. That's MVMT.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for being with me. Joining me in just a moment will be Nora Barry, and Nora is the co-founder and president of Bridgeview Media. And Nora works with executives in trying to help them with their brand storytelling in a more effective way. I wanted to remind you that we have sponsorship and advertising opportunities if you'd like to be a part of the show and gain some media exposure for yourself or your company. Feel free to email me directly at susan@womentowatch.net. So now I'm very honored and excited to welcome to the show Nora Barry. Nora, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sue. Glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. You know, as I was reviewing my notes and kind of drafting my questions for the interview, I realized how much we seem to have in common, particularly the Irish roots and the Philadelphia area.
Yes, I just came back from Ireland, actually.
Oh, you did? Where were you?
In Dublin, and then did a lot of day trips around Dublin. I'm just mad about the megalithic monuments in the Boyne Valley, so I've been there before, and I went back.
So fun. It's such a great place, and of course, the people, I think, are what makes Ireland such a special place.
Yes, and it's very, Dublin is very international. That was my first time back there since post-Brexit. And now that Ireland is the only English-speaking country left in the EU, Dublin has just boomed, and like one in every 10 people are Irish, but everybody else is from somewhere else. It was fascinating. Yeah.
And that's happening in the north, I believe, as well. Companies, several Fortune 500s have opened up offices up in Belfast.
Probably, because they managed to cut a deal when they pulled out of Brexit to keep the north of Ireland in the EU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, of course, one of the traits, I would say, of the Irish is the love of storytelling and stories, which is where you focus your work. And really, I would say, help executives understand the importance of it. But let's talk just a quick bit about your background. You were born and raised in the Philadelphia area.
Yes.
After a long line of Irish immigrants, I guess, coming over to the U.S. And also a large family, one of six. And your grandmother lived with you.
Yes.
So I want to with an open door, right? An open door.
My parents had a very open door when we were growing up.
Yeah. So I know that, you know, you shared with me that as a kid, you were a little bit shy and quiet. How did you handle the noise and the people coming and going?
Well, I was a big reader, and a friend of mine still says that when she would come get me and say, let's go out and play, I'd be curled up under the piano reading because it was a place where nobody else was. So I read a lot. I think like a lot of writers, I read my way through my childhood.
Yeah. And tell me about your relationship with your grandmother.
Oh, well, we used to tease that she was the Hallmark, the boilerplate for the Hallmark grandmother, because she was white-haired and soft-spoken and could recite poetry at the drop of a hat, and was very loving and a good cook. Really one of the most educated women I've ever met. And because she was Catholic, she was forced to drop out of school in sixth grade because she was raised in the North, and that was not a place that was friendly to Catholics when she was growing up in the late 1800s, so 1890s. So she was forced to drop out of school, but she came over here at 17, went back to school, and became a nurse. So she's really an amazing woman.
That was, I think, fairly common. My grandmother yes. also came and went to nursing school.
Yes. Either that yeah. or become a servant, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, did you know, so she had some ambition herself. Did she talk to you about, you know, your future and your dreams? And you know, I would say when they didn't have the support that women should have for pursuing something outside of being a mother, did she talk to you about that and kind of encourage you to find your mm-hmm. aspirations?
No, I would say when she married, everybody in my family married late. So she was in her 30s when she married. She stopped working. My other grandmother, my Nana on my mother's side, was actually a flapper, and she walked herself down the aisle because her father had died, and bought herself a car and taught herself to drive. And my whole time growing up, my Nana worked and was very ambitious. And there was never any doubt. She sent my mother and her sisters to college in the 1940s when women were just not educated. And my father also went to college in the 40s, and that was at my grandmother, my Irish grandmother's insistence. So education was actually a very big thing in my family. Going way back, my mother's great-great-grandfather, who came over during the Great Hunger, came over at the age of 16. 20 years later, in the 1880s, he sent his son to Villanova University, which was then Villanova College. So education has always been a standard, a leitmotif in my family's life, I think. And always something that I grew up knowing I would go to college and I would work. That was just the way it was.
And your love of books and stories obviously came to you at a very young age. Did you know when you were deciding where to go to college that you were going to pursue something in the area of literature, storytelling, communications?
No, actually, surprisingly, I went to college as a French major. And my first day of school, I switched my major to political philosophy because I had a teacher. I walked into his class and fell in love with it and became a political philosophy major and a minor in French. And it wasn't until I went to grad school that I went back to communications.
Okay. Something else you shared with me, I think, that was impactful for you was being a Girl Scout.
Yes. Yes. I don't think we talk about that enough. You know what I mean? I think Girl Scouts are a great organization. They teach women how to take themselves seriously and how to lead, I think. You know, we had great Girl Scout leaders when I was in junior high. They said, if you sell X amount of cookies, we'll go on a trip. And we all sold cookies and got on a plane and flew to Boston for 3 days. So Girl Scouts for me was really a great experience. You know, I don't know what it's like these days. I don't know if it's as popular, but it was great. And I always stop and buy Girl Scout cookies every year as a result.
It stays with you.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, I'm not sure the year the Girl Scouts were founded, but just that cookie sale contest among the girls was introducing them to business, right?
How to sell. Yes, actually, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
So I wonder if they've implemented something today that goes a little bit above and beyond the cookie sales, but teaching young women about finance, I think, is really important.
Yes. Yes. How to ask for the sale. And when I go to buy cookies now from Girl Scouts, I always say to them, tell me about the cookies. Tell me which are your favorite. Tell me which ones I should buy, because it's teaching you to put yourself forward, to pitch a product, which is never a bad thing. And then also to calculate, you know what I mean? How to calculate the cost of the sale and all of that. It's a great experience.
Yeah, we talk about on the show quite often about the importance of learning about money in school and how that should be taught in addition to math.
Yes.
Right? It's how we live in society.
Yes. And I don't think, I mean, my mother was an English and reading teacher, and she said to me in grade school, oh, honey, you don't really have to worry too much about math. And so I didn't. And now I run a business. And I had to learn how to think about math. So yeah, not great advice, Mom.
I have a quote, Nora. You said, I was pretty shy and quiet as a kid, so the quiet life of a writer appealed to me greatly. How would you describe yourself today as opposed to that young little girl who just preferred to kind of be by herself?
Well, not shy and quiet, but I will tell you that having grown up that way gives me a lot of empathy when I go to coach somebody before they have to go on stage. Because I remember, I mean, I was so shy that I would blush when people would talk to me. I really did. So it gives me a lot of empathy when I go to coach executives before they go on stage about, you know, I feel their pain. I know what they're going through. I think, you know, I taught myself to be more outgoing, actually, by going out for cheerleading in high school. I forced myself to go out for cheerleading, and that certainly cured my shyness pretty quickly, standing in front of a crowd that way. I think today I'm much more outgoing. I'm very collaborative. I enjoy the quiet of reading, and I still enjoy the quiet of writing. But I think I said this to you. When I went to grad school for communication, it was a very collaborative, very creatively collaborative experience. And that really changed how I looked at creating and creativity as being sort of, you can do so much by yourself, but when you're put in a room with a group of people and you come together to work on a project, and we did a lot of television production in grad school, so it was by nature collaborative. When you bring that many people together, you become better. The sum of the parts exceeds the whole. And I've learned, to me, that's also something I take with me into my work. I seek feedback. I constantly seek feedback, or I ask other people to come in and do something as well. Because I think when you surround yourself with people who are as good or better than you, you level yourself up and you get better and they get better.
Yes, I agree. You know, you can't be alone and have all the creativity and ideas by yourself. It's just, it won't be as broad of a creative piece or, you know, project. Something you did, and very impressive, in 1997, you started a company, an online film company called The Bit Screen. Mm-hmm. The very first. That's, yes. Okay, so tell us, where did that idea come from?
Well, it started, I started studying story, I guess, in the early 90s, really beginning to look at the structure of story and how story had evolved. And I began reading, my sons were young in the early 90s, and we began reading a lot of stories from around the world. And I began to see how stories were very similar from country to country, and it made me very interested in sort of the global aspect to storytelling. And I'm already a student of languages. In addition to French, I've studied German and Italian and Spanish. So all that sort of made me start looking at how people tell stories around the world. And I had sold a couple of screenplays in the early 90s, but I couldn't move out to California because my kids were young at the time. So I went looking for another way to tell stories. And I was working, true story, I was working with AT&T on the launch of what was then called dial-up video conferencing, which is what we're doing now. And I thought, oh my gosh, you can put video out over a phone line. And that made me really curious. And I went and I researched the technology. And then maybe in 1997, there were some early experiments in short films. And by short, I mean 30 seconds to 60 seconds on the internet. So I thought, you know what, this is a medium in which I want to tell a story. So I went to Comcast and they had put up something called Comcast at Home. And I said, if you give me a space on your site, I will provide content to you in the shape of short films. And then I went out and took a coding course and learned how to code the website. And I went out and I found a bunch of filmmakers I knew and said, hey, there's this new medium. Here are the technological constraints. Can you make a film for me that has to be 1 minute or less? It can't have a lot going on. There were a lot of parameters or a lot of restrictions in those days. And I found a couple of willing collaborators, and we launched the website, and I worked hard at the promotion of it. And after about 6 months, the New York Times put it on the front page of the Sunday Arts and Leisure section, and it went international. It went around the world. It just took off. And that led me to do a lot of storytelling projects around the world in other countries. I traveled a lot. I continued my research in story. I did a lot of experimental programs. And then I pulled back in 2005, right as YouTube was launching.
Okay.
So I did it for about 7 years. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that you, this is such an important lesson. You had this idea and you took action. You went to a company and said, here's something I can do for you. And I think that's something people struggle with, not just women. Many people will have an idea or thought about something new, but not have the belief that it could actually come to fruition. So
right.
How did you have that confidence in taking this idea, something never done before?
So my dad was an entrepreneur. He ran, among other things, one of the first local newspapers, free weekly newspapers in Philadelphia. So I grew up in an entrepreneurial household, understanding that it was okay to take risks. And I'm not afraid to take risks. I never have been. I don't know whether that resilience is inborn or it's something that I've bred, but I'm not afraid to take risks. And I thought, you know, why not go for it? You know, the worst Comcast can do is say no. The worst anybody can do to me is say no. I'm going to go give it a try, right? So, yeah. Encouraging people to take risks. It's funny you ask that question. I think the willingness to take a risk and being unafraid of failure are hallmarks of successful entrepreneurs.
Hmm. Or to be afraid. Women often say this to me, or to be afraid and do it anyway.
Do it anyway. Yeah, do it anyway.
Right? Yeah.
Everybody's always afraid, you know, but
yes.
If you go ahead and do it anyway, you know. Nothing gained.
Yes, absolutely. There's always that second guessing. But if you can make yourself do it anyway, knowing that what is the worst that can happen? If it fails, you're in the same place you were before.
And I think a lot of that does come from how you were raised. It's funny. I was asked to write a speech about resilience a couple of years ago for an executive. And she said to me, I want to know whether resilience is your people are born with resilience or it's a trait or a characteristic they acquire. So I did a lot of research and I came back to her and I said, you know what? I think it's a little bit of both. But for me, it was definitely innate. And that muscle got stronger the more I exercised it. And it's something I raised my own sons with, just saying, give it a try. You know, what the hell? If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But give it a try, you know?
Yeah. Listen, we have to go into our first break. And when we come back, I want to talk about something you share with me that was probably one of the greatest personal challenges that you have had in life so far.
Okay.
Stay with us as we go into our break, where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of partners, and we'll be back with Nora Barry.
Hi, my name is Christy McCaffrey. I'm the founder and owner of Be The Good Media, and I'm here to share some good news with you. Today, I wanted to share with you about a woman who is truly doing meaningful and impact-driven work in her community. Her name is Corinne O'Connell. Corinne is the CEO of Habitat for Humanity Philadelphia. And as CEO, Corinne and her team work to make sure that every person in our city has a decent place to live. I was truly inspired in speaking with Corinne on my show because it was just so clear how passionate she is about making a meaningful impact in her community and in the lives of those she serves, not just today, but for many more years to come. You can hear more of my conversation with Corinne at BeTheGoodMedia.com. And there you will also learn more about how Be The Good Media helps to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Stay tuned here on Women to Watch Media for more good news.
Ladies, I'm Tiffany Curtin, a financial professional with more than 25 years of experience serving successful women, families, and businesses. Here's the reality. You don't have to be the one managing your family's finances to take ownership of your future. But if you want true confidence about how everything is going to play out, you do have to take part in the process. That doesn't mean digging into the weeds of your finances when you don't have the time or desire. It means elevating your awareness of your own circumstances. It means having the bigger conversations so you're empowered when you need to be. Let's bring confidence to your family's future without overwhelming your time. Call myself at 903-520-2709. That's 903-520-2709. Or visit Johnson Financial Group on our website, www.jfg.cc. Not .com, www.jfg.cc.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior leaders grow. Today on Leadership Watch, we're going to talk about being in the driver's seat of your career. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you need to grasp that you are in the driver's seat. Understanding from day one that you and you alone are responsible for your career is critical. After all, why would you hand your career over to someone else to manage? There's no one as vested in yourself as you. And the ugly truth is that most managers are focused on execution rather than team development. So how can you ensure that your career stays on track? First, make sure you have a clear set of agreed upon goals that are measurable, and if priorities shift, rewrite them with buy-in. Two, if you see something that can be improved upon or automated, don't wait to be asked, just do it. This is good advice for tech-savvy millennials and Gen Zs who can help lead the way with AI. Three, don't insulate yourself. Get to know other parts of the organization and network both internally and externally. Feel free to drive outside of your lane. And four, while your career is yours to own, don't go it alone. Identify sponsors and mentors. Also, it's important to make self-reflection and self-assessment a habit. Think through where you want to be 5 years from now and create a roadmap for yourself. Does your current path get you there? Are you passionate about what you're doing? Do you feel challenged? Are you learning? Do you feel respected? And importantly, are you a cultural fit? And is the company a cultural fit for you? If you answer negative to any of these questions, it's likely time for some course correcting. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, check out expoleadership.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Nora Barry. And Nora Barry is the co-founder and president of Bridgeview Media, an advisory and consultancy firm for executives, particularly around the importance of storytelling and telling the story of their brand. You know, we were talking before the break about the connection between whether we're born with something, resilience in particular, or whether we develop that over time. And so I'm always very interested in those beginning years. And the fact that you did some backpacking all by yourself across Europe or France was surprising to me. And really? What were you hoping to find? Most young people who do that are going to find themselves. So they backpack across Europe. What was your, actually, you were you in school at the time?
I was in school, yeah. I got bored in college and I came home one over break and I said to my parents, I think I want to go to school in Europe next semester. And my dad went out and bought me a backpack and said, okay, here you go.
So he was all for it.
He was like, okay, buy the backpack. So I applied directly to universities in France. I didn't go through my college actually had a program in Switzerland, and I was a French snob at the time. And I thought, why go to Switzerland to learn French? I'm going to France. So I applied to a school, and so I went by myself.
Yeah,
I was 21. I was 21.
Okay.
A baby. But these days you think about people are so tethered to their parents by cell phones and by the internet and by everything. And my parents took me to the airport, dropped me off, said, you know, write us a letter.
Letter writing.
I landed in Paris. I got lost. Somebody came and said, oh, here, I'll help you find your way. And then she befriended me and I hung out with her. And then I took the train down. I actually studied in the Loire Valley, which, you know, in France. And I took the train down. I didn't know anybody. I went to school and I would use my weekends and my breaks to just backpack. And it was phenomenal because I had a Eurail pass. And I can remember taking the train from Angers to Paris and getting to the train station and looking at that board that had all of the departing trains on it, sort of like the ones you see in airports, and saying, gosh, where do I want to go? Let's see, there. And then I would just go to the train. And that sense of freedom is something I think you can only have when you're young. So I'm really glad I did it. And I just traveled all over Europe by myself.
Yeah. And also that was pre-internet, right?
So pre-internet.
Having the knowledge of all of the horrific things going on around the world. So you didn't probably have any fear.
Well, in those days, a woman traveling alone was at risk. I mean, I think even today, women traveling alone are at risk. And I got into literally one time, Sue, I came back into Paris and missed my train out to Angers. And I don't know, it was maybe 3 a.m. and the next train wasn't until 6. And the train station was filled with, you know, unsavory characters, shall we say. And I thought,
at Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is not a good place for me to be. And I found the station manager and I knocked on his door and he opened it and I said, you need to let me in here because I can't sit out in the waiting room by myself. And he said, oh, I can't do that because I have to go out on rounds. And I said, fine, then lock me in your office, but I'm not going to stay out in the waiting room by myself. And, you know, I was speaking in French and he was French and he kind of went, okay. And he let me into his office. And so
yeah, that was smart.
You had to find your way around and learn how to take care of yourself. And that's not a bad thing.
Right. So let's talk about storytelling. Let's talk about when you co-founded Bridgeview Media in 2017. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I wanted to ask you, how would you describe the difference between providing information and storytelling? So in the world of business, if you're working with an executive and getting them to understand the importance of connecting personally or in a personal manner with someone, what is the definition between the two? I don't know if I'm articulating that correctly. But
So how do I teach somebody what story is and how do I teach them why it's important is, I think, what you're asking. And generally what I do in that process is I will start with other presentations they have made, and I'll go through and I'll just take a look at how they organize the information. And then I talk to them about the importance, or I talk to them about why story works. I generally start with the science of story. You know, why does story work? Why does it actually change people's emotions? Why does it actually hardwire their brains differently? And then I talk to them how, I show them how telling a story, you can use a narrative structure for a background of all of the information that you need to give somebody. There should be a beginning, middle, and an end in every presentation, even in a PowerPoint. Most people don't think about it that way. Generally, when I'm conducting a storytelling workshop, I'll say, how many people begin their PowerPoint presentation by opening up their computer and opening up their PowerPoint presentation? And they all raise their hand. And I say to them, really, what you need to do is outline. You need to say, what's the beginning? What's the middle? How am I progressing when I'm showing the information? And then what is the end? And then once you begin to get them to understand the narrative structure, you show them how to build tension into it. So if they're giving a presentation on a project that was developed to solve a specific problem, start with the before. What was the situation like before this project existed? Put the audience in that place. Maybe the audience even experienced that. Then show the struggles that you went to develop this response. And then show if you tried and failed, you tried, had to change it. Then show what happened when it actually succeeded. And now tell them the aftermath of that. How was life better for everybody else? That's a simple Cinderella narrative structure. And it can work in a PowerPoint presentation. And so generally what I to be frank, I use fairy tales. I break down fairy tales and I teach story structure through well-known fairy tales. And then I take their PowerPoint presentations and I show them how they can begin to adhere to that narrative structure, create engagement, drive emotion, and leave people more interested and make it more memorable.
Correct. Yes. And I'm having a little bit of a flashback to my journalism years at Villanova when I learned the 5 W's, who, yes. What, when, where, and why.
Nobody knows what those are anymore.
Right. Is that any part of your teachings? Because I do think those 5 words, who, what, where, when, why, I always think being one of the most important, does make for a complete story if you touch all of those.
Yes. And I think people need to have the who, what, when, where, how, and why before they begin writing. And I think one of the things we've lost in communication, well, we've lost a lot of things in communication today, but we've lost a sense of outlining, understanding why am I telling this story? Who do I need to reach? What change do I need to affect? How am I going to communicate this message? You know, is it via video? Is it via PowerPoint? So these are all who, what, when, where, how, why questions that need to be answered before anybody begins their presentation. So yes, the 5 W's are part of the building block. But also, you know, the journalistic structure is the inverse pyramid. So you start out with the most important information. Remember that one? So you start the pyramid, and then it comes down to, because they always thought in newspapers, people would read everything they wanted. They would try to read everything they could in the first 3 paragraphs and try to get everything from that. They would not necessarily go all the way down to the bottom. So your most important information was at the top and your least important information, right, was at the bottom. So the inverse pyramid structure, and I've actually had to teach that in storytelling workshops and communication classes. But I don't know that holds exactly true, the inverse pyramid for storytelling or making, you know, storytelling in presentation or storytelling in a speech. I think the inverse pyramid is an incredibly useful tool in communicating important news that you need to get across the screen and effectively.
Yes, Yes, it's like that headline that grabs you. Right. You know, often I will open up the Wall Street Journal and I can look at all the headlines and find out what's happening without diving fully into
that article. That's the purpose of it, right?
Yes. So I understand you deal specifically with companies in pharma, life science, and technology.
Yes.
What led you to those industries specifically?
Technology is something I got into very early on. Clearly, I was working in the 90s in dial-up video conferencing. I worked for AT&T. I don't know. I think just my first freelance writing gig out of grad school was in technology. And I treated it like a like another language. And I went out and bought a dictionary of telecommunications, believe it or not. And I also bought a book on telephone, how to wire telephone, you know, with telephone wires, so I could understand the basic infrastructure. And I just found technology to be really fascinating. Clearly, in the past 30 years, it's been a time of tremendous growth in technology and a lot of change. So I was able to be involved in that at a terrific period. And then about, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, a client reached out to me and said, can you work with this LifeSite client? We need a couple of speeches for chief medical officers. And I did not tell them that I had gotten an F+ in biology and that had been my very, last science course.
Was it triggering? It was triggering, right? You thought, I don't want to go back.
No, I think the nun only gave me a plus because she felt sorry for me, but it was a Catholic school. So I just treated it like a whole new language and learned the language and just started doing a lot of life sciences.
I'm so impressed by your interest in just kind of being self-taught, just looking to, you have an interest and you dive in and you're going to learn about it and you're going to get better at that.
Yes, I'm able to teach myself. That's very true.
Yeah. Something I actually mentioned in the first segment, and I want to come back to it because I always find it important in these interviews for my guests to share things they've been through that have been personally a challenge, that have impacted who they are, and then they continue to, you know, rise to levels of leadership. And you shared with me, you know, a divorce that you went through that was very difficult. Particularly for your boys. Tell me, how did that change you?
Well, it wasn't difficult for them because they were both still in diapers. They didn't really know anything about it. They didn't know any other lifestyle. It was a choice to leave the marriage, and it was a good choice. It was the right choice. I think being a single working parent, especially when your children are that young, makes you incredibly organized. And I will tell you, I was not always deadline driven. I remember celebrating the arrival of FedEx so I could overnight something to a client. And then of course, with the advent of the internet, I was always up the night before working, but I remember being on deadline for a project and it had been written, but I was rewriting it that morning, my plan was to rewrite it that morning that it was due. And I woke up and both of my kids had the chicken pox.
Oh, geez.
So I put them on the floor in my office and covered them with a blanket and met my deadline and thought, I will never wait to the last minute ever again. And I haven't. And I think single parenting is not for the faint of heart. Let me put it to you that way.
It's hard.
It's hard. And it makes you tough. It makes you very resilient. I mean, even more I'm already resilient. It made me much stronger and it made me very organized and it helped me prioritize what I need to do in my life.
And probably the feeling of independence is a positive, although I would say from how you've shared, you know, your life story, you had confidence, you were independent. So this kind of experience that left you now alone with children, not having that somebody to turn to, perhaps didn't change you as much as far as who you are and how you approach life and work?
No, again, it was my choice to leave. And I don't have any issues with doing things on my own. I am very independent and have been for a long time. So that wasn't an issue. I think it's just, it makes you, you know, it's a job you live 24/7 and there's never anybody to hand it off to. So it just makes you one of the great schedulers in life.
Yeah. Do you have a big calendar?
My God, no, I had, and I still have, it's an obsession with me. I have a calendar over my desk. I have the calendar on my laptop. I have the calendar, a paper calendar on my desk planner. I have another calendar in the kitchen. I'm very calendar oriented.
Well, not only are you the president of this company, but you are very active in other ways. You sit on multiple boards. You do an enormous amount of volunteer work. If I were to ask you what you're most proud of sitting here today in your life, what would that be?
Professionally, I would say the book I published last year about storytelling. I'm very proud of that. I think the book that I published and the work that I've been able to do in story, it's something that feeds me. It's not just something I do professionally. Story really is a passion for me. I think of myself as a student of story and, you know, going all the way back to when I launched the Bit Screen, I've got a bookshelf filled with books on narrative and fairy tales from around the world and, you know, medieval fairy tales and mythological stories. So it's a passion for me, and being able to finally write a book about it was a huge accomplishment for me.
Was it enjoyable enough that you're thinking about your next book?
Oh my God, no, writing by yourself is not enjoyable. I think it is. I said, you know, I changed my mind about the quiet life of a writer. I think it. I will tell you, I'm on the board at the Athenaeum, which is about 210-year-old library here in Philadelphia, private lending library. And I would go there and I would work because you can't have a phone in that library. There's no distractions allowed. They do have internet, but no phone. And that was the only way I got the writing down, is I would take myself over there and I would just turn off everything and then I would write. And that's a commitment, you know. Yeah, it's hard. Writing by yourself is hard.
Well, I just think, right, I think writing in general, at length, you know, there's a difference between writing a book, right, and drafting an email.
Right.
And I think, yeah.
And I've published articles, I've published chapters over the years, I've contributed to books. But, you know, that's 5,000 words. That's not that hard to write. Well, it takes time. I don't want to put that down, but yeah. 5,000 words is very different than 50,000 words. And I think I was around 50,000 words in the book. You have to really think about, when you're writing a book like that, that you really hope people will use as an informational asset or a tool for in their own lives, you constantly have to say to yourself when you're writing, or I did anyway, does this make sense to my audience? It makes sense to me. I'm a student of story. Am I too far up here? Should I come down more here? You constantly have to put yourself in your reader's shoes to make sure they understand what you're saying to them and that the examples work.
When I think about all of your volunteer work that you do, is there one cause that's near and dear to your heart?
Well, I'm a tree tender in the city of Philadelphia. I plant trees a couple times a year with Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, and I love doing that. I'm a gardener, and I love doing that.
Yeah, I love that.
Being around my neighborhood and seeing trees that have grown up over the years. So that's near and dear to my heart. the Athenaeum, I just rolled on. I just was elected to that board. So probably those two things.
Yeah, but the cities need green.
You know, there are so many studies that show that in urban areas where there's more tree canopy, there's less crime. There's less violence.
No, I never read that.
Yeah.
That research. That's interesting.
I think if I had $10 million, my foundation would be a book for every child, a tree to read it under, and a full belly, you know?
You just gave me such a great interview question. If you had, did you say 5 million?
I don't volunteer for Philabundance, but they're, I've pretty much stopped giving Christmas presents, you know, because who needs it at this point? But I do make donations in people's names. And now my friends and I, we do that, and they'll call up and they say, you know, what shall I donate to? And I say, you know, Philabundance, because they feed families in Philadelphia all year round.
Yes. My last question for you, if someone's watching and listening and you were to describe how Bridgeview Media is different from other consultancy companies, how would you describe that?
We have a real story focus. I mean, I have my own background in story, and my colleague and partner, Mike Adams, comes from 25, 30 years in the news business. So he's very story and audience focused. He's actually taught me a lot about being audience focused. So we really have a real focus on story, how to help people tell a better story, what is your story, and also on strategy. I love playing chess, and it hones my skills, I think, when I'm working with clients and I'm trying to understand what it is they need to say, how they need to say it, who are they trying to reach, again, what kind of behavior are they trying to change. I love the strategy of that. So our focus is really story and strategy.
You used the phrase earlier in the interviews, the science of story. And I don't think people understand there is a science to storytelling.
Yes, there is. There's a science to why story works, very much so. Story, there's a neurophysicist whom I follow named Yuri Hassan, and he has done studies that show that story can actually hardwire our brains. So if we're paying close attention, when we're paying close attention to each other, our brains, literally our brain patterns mimic each other. So if I'm talking to you and you're fully engaged, the brain patterns that my brain is emitting from the story that I'm telling are actually reflected in your brain. And he's done MRI scans of this and everything. So
wow, that's fascinating.
Story is fascinating. Story is absolutely fascinating. Yeah, on a lot of levels. Culturally, yeah. Scientifically, emotionally, strategically.
Yeah, that's really good to hear and good to know.
Yes.
Because I could listen to people tell stories all day long. It's my favorite thing to do. So my connections must be firing.
Your synapses are firing, right?
They're firing, even if I'm not reading a million books.
It's really more person-to-person communication when that happens, you know, or live communication when you're telling a story to somebody else, or in this situation on video, when you're engaged with the person as well.
Yeah. It's all interesting. Nora, and I thank you for taking time to be on the show and share your personal and professional life.
Thank you, Sue. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Stay with us as we go into our next break, and I'll be back to close out the show. Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has long been ranked as one of the best children's hospitals in the country. In our Women to Watch at CHOP series, we'll meet the women working to preserve this best-in-class pediatric innovation. Let's meet Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, Sophia Holder. Sophia, just take a minute to kind of introduce yourself to our guests. Tell them a little bit about where you came from and how you ended up in this role.
Yes, and thank you, Susan, for just the amazing work that you do to inspire women leadership. I would still call myself as new to CHOP. Started just over 3 years ago, and I'm honestly in my dream job in an organization that is focused on delivering and innovating care for children. And so it's hard not to find joy in that space. My career in healthcare spans many years, starting in the adult side and now on the pediatric side. And I'm just really thrilled to be with you today.
What advice would you have for our listeners and our viewers listening to you today?
So I would offer two pieces of advice. Focus on continuous learning. Be a life learner. That's the frame that I often use with those who work with me and for me. Stay updated on industry trends. Continuously seek opportunities for learning and growth. Knowledge is power in any leadership role. I think the other piece of advice I would give is model authenticity. Be authentic and true to yourself. Authentic leadership builds trust and loyalty among your team and your peers, foundational to building effective teams and supporting cross-collaboration and partnership.
Thanks so much to Sophia Holder for joining us. Stay tuned for more Women to Watch at CHOP.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors and our Watch Team partners for bringing us their content and contributions to the show. Next week, I'll be talking to Laura Miranda, and Laura is the co-founder of Be Partners, and Laura's going to talk about her life not only as a professional business owner, but her life as a mother of 2 sets of twins. So she has some great stories for us. Have a great week, everybody.
Movement has the biggest deals of the holiday season and the sleekest watches around. Whether you're gifting for family, friends, or yourself, shop 30 to 60% off Movement's variety of designs, colorways, and functionalities. From the thinnest automatic dress watch under $500 to waterproof guarantee adventure-ready sport watches to rare ceramics. Be the good gifter this year. Shop 30 to 60% off now at movement.com and enjoy fast and free shipping. That's MVMT.com.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.